This is Audible.
The Story of Elsa by Joy Adamson. Read by Joanna David. For many years, my home has been in the northern frontier province of Kenya, that vast stretch of semi-arid thornbush, covering some 120,000 square miles, which extends from Mount Kenya to the Abyssinian border. Civilization has made little impact on this part of Africa. There are no settlers. The local tribes live very much as their fathers did, and the place abounds in wildlife of every description. My husband, George, is senior game warden of this huge territory, and our home is on the southern border of the province, near Eziolo, a small township of about 30 whites, all of whom are government officials, engaged in the task of administering the territory. George has many duties, such as enforcing the game laws, preventing poaching, and dealing with dangerous animals that have molested the tribesmen. His work causes him to travel over tremendous distances. These journeys we call safaris. Whenever it is possible, I accompany him, and in this way I have had unique opportunities of coming to grips with this wild, unchanged land, where life is tough and nature asserts her own laws. This story has its beginning on one of these safaris. A Boran tribesman had been killed by a man-eating lion. It was reported to George that this animal, accompanied by two lionesses, was living in some nearby hills, and so it became his duty to track them down. Early on the morning of the 1st of February, 1956, I found myself in camp alone with Patty, a rock hyrax, who had been living with us as a pet for 6.5 years. She looked like a marmot or a guinea pig, though zoologists will have it that on account of the bone structure of its feet and teeth, the hyrax is most nearly related to rhinos and elephants. Suddenly, I heard the vibrations of a car. This could only mean that George was returning much earlier than expected. Soon our Land Rover broke through the thorn bush and stopped near our tents, and I heard George shout, "Joy, where are you? Quick, I have something for you." I rushed out with Patty on my shoulder and saw the skin of a lion. But before I could ask about the hunt, George pointed to the back of the car. There were three lion cubs, tiny balls of spotted fur. They were only a few weeks old, and their eyes were still covered with a bluish film. I took them on my lap to comfort them, while George, who was most distressed, told me what had happened. Towards dawn, he and another game warden, Ken, had been guided near to the place where the man-eater was said to lie up. When first light broke, they were charged by a lioness who rushed out from behind some rocks. Though they had no wish to kill her, she was very close, and the way back was hazardous. The lioness came straight at Ken. George could not shoot, for Ken was in his line of fire. Fortunately, a game scout who was in a more favourable position fired his rifle and caused the animal to swerve. Then George was able to kill her. She was a big lioness, in the prime of life, her teeth swollen with milk. It was only when he saw this that George realised why she had been so angry and faced them so courageously. Then he blamed himself for not having recognised earlier that her behaviour showed that she was defending her litter. He ordered a search to be made for the cubs. Now they lay in my lap, and how could I resist making a fuss of them? To my amazement, Patty, who was usually very jealous of any rival, soon came to nestle among them, and obviously accepted them as desirable companions. From that day onwards, the four became inseparable. It was 2 days before the cubs accepted their first milk. Then they could not get enough of it, and every 2 hours I had to warm it and clean the flexible rubber tube, which we'd taken from the wireless set, to serve as a teat until we were able to get a proper baby's bottle. We'd sent at once to the nearest African market, which was about 50 miles away, not only for the teat, but also for cod liver oil, glucose, and cases of unsweetened milk. All the cubs were females. Even at this age, each had a definite character. The big one had a benevolent superiority and was generous towards the others. The second was a clown, always laughing and spanking her milk bottle with both her front paws as she drank, her eyes closed in bliss. I named her Lustica, which means the jolly one. The third cub was the weakling in size, but the pluckiest in spirit, and was always sent by the others to reconnoitre when something looked suspicious to them. I called her Elsa, because she reminded me of someone of that name. In the natural course of events, Elsa would probably have been the throw-out of the pride. The average number of cubs in a litter is four, of which one usually dies soon after birth, and another is often too weak to be reared. It is for this reason that one usually sees only two cubs with a lioness. Their mother looks after them till they are 2 years old. For the first year, she provides their food. She regurgitates it, thus making it acceptable to them. During the second year, the cubs are allowed to take part in the hunting, but they get severely disciplined if they lose their self-control. Since at this time they are unable to kill on their own, they have to rely for their food on what may be left over from a kill by the full-grown lions of the pride. Nature's law is harsh, and lions have to learn the hard way from the beginning. The quartet, Patty and the three cubs, spent most of the day in the tent under my camp bed. This evidently seemed to them a safe place and the nearest thing they could find to their natural nursery. They were by nature house-trained and always took great care to reach the sand outside. There were a few accidents during the first days, but afterwards, on the rare occasions when a little pool disgraced their home, they meowed and made comical grimaces of disgust. In every way, they were wonderfully clean, and had no smell, except for a very pleasant one like honey, or was it cod liver oil? When, after 2 weeks, we returned to Isiolo, everyone came to see them. The cubs loved Europeans, and especially small children, but had a marked dislike of Africans. The only exception was a young Somali called Nuru. He was our garden boy. Now we appointed him guardian and lion keeper in chief. The post pleased him, for it raised his social status. For 12 weeks, we kept the cubs on a diet of unsweetened milk, mixed with cod liver oil, glucose, bone meal, and a little salt. By now their eyes were fully opened, but they could not yet judge distances and often missed their target. To help them over this difficulty, we gave them rubber balls and old inner tubes to play with. The latter were perfect for tug-of-war games. Indeed, anything made of rubber or that was soft and flexible fascinated them. They stalked each other, and us, from the earliest age, and knew by instinct how to do it properly. They always attacked from the rear. Keeping under cover, they crouched, then crept slowly towards the unsuspecting victim, until the final rush was made at flying speed, the attacker landing on the back of her quarry. Patty always wanted to be in the game, though as the cubs were soon 3 times her size, she took good care to avoid being squashed. If the cubs became too aggressive, she put them in their places by just turning round and facing them. I admired her spirit, for small as she was, it needed a lot of courage to convince them of her fearlessness. The more so that her only defences were her sharp teeth, quick reactions, intelligence, and pluck. She had come to us when she was newly born, and had entirely adapted her life to ours. Unlike her cousin, the tree hyrax, she was not a nocturnal animal, and at night she would sleep round my neck like a fur. She was a vegetarian, but had a craving for alcohol, and for the strongest spirits at that. Whenever the opportunity arose, she would pull the bottle over, extract the cork and swig the liquor. As this was very bad for Patty's health, not to mention her morale, we took every precaution to prevent any indulgence in whiskey or gin. Her excretory habits were peculiar. Rock, Hyraxes always use the same place, for preference, the edge of a rock. At home, Patty invariably perched herself on the rim of the lavatory seat, and thus situated, presented a comical sight. On safari, where no such refinements were provided for her, she was completely bewildered, so we had eventually to rig up a small lavatory for her. Until the cubs came, Patty had always been number one among our pets, so I was very touched that she should continue to love the little rascals, even though they diverted our visitors' attention from herself. When the cubs were 3 months old, they had teeth big enough to make it possible for them to eat meat. So now I gave them raw minced meat, which was the best we could do to imitate their mother's regurgitated food. For several days they refused to touch it. Then Lustica made the experiment and found it to her taste. The others took courage from her, and soon there was a fight at every meal. This meant that poor Elsa, who was still weaker than the others, had little chance of getting her fair share. So I kept the titbits for her and used to take her on my lap for her meals. She loved this. Rolling her head from side to side and closing her eyes, she showed how happy she was. At these times, she would suck my thumbs and massage my thighs with her front paws, as though she were kneading her mother's belly in order to get some more milk. We combined playing with feeding, and my days were happily spent with these charming creatures. They were lazy by nature, and it needed a lot of persuasion to get them to move from a comfortable position. Even the most desirable marrow bone was not worth the effort of getting up, and they would roll into position to get at it the easiest way. But best of all, they liked me to hold their bone for them while they lay on their backs, paws in the air, and sucked at it. The more we got to know the cubs, the more we loved them. So it was hard to accept the fact that we could not keep forever 3 fast-growing lions. Regretfully, we decided that 2 must go, and that it would be better that the 2 big ones, who were always together and less dependent on us than Elsa, should be the ones to leave. As to Elsa, we felt that if she had only ourselves as friends, she would be easy to train, not only for life at Isiolo, but also as a travelling companion on our safaris. As a home for Lustica and the big one, we chose the Rotterdam Blydorp Zoo and made arrangements for them to make the journey by air. They would have to leave from Nairobi, which was 180 miles away. When we drove off, Elsa ran a short way down the drive and then stood with the most mournful expression in her eyes, watching the car in which her 2 sisters were disappearing. I travelled in the back, and the cubs lay beside me, embracing me with their paws. We travelled like this for 11 hours, delayed by 2 blowouts. The lions could not have been more trusting. When we reached Nairobi, they looked at me with their large eyes, puzzled to know what to make of all the strange noises and smells. Then the plane carried them off forever from their native land. After a few days, we received a cable announcing the safe arrival of our cubs in Holland. When I visited them, about 3 years later, they accepted me as a friendly person and allowed me to stroke them, but they did not recognize me. They lived in splendid conditions, and on the whole, I was glad to know that almost certainly they had no recollection of a freer life. While I was absent in Nairobi, George told me that Elsa was very much upset and never left him for a moment. She followed him around, sat under his office desk where he was working, and at night slept on his bed. Each evening he took her for a walk, but on the day of my return she refused to accompany him and sat herself down expectantly in the middle of the drive. Nothing would move her. Could it have been that she knew I was coming back? If so, to what animal instinct can one attribute such foreknowledge? Behaviour of this kind is difficult, if not impossible, to explain. When I arrived alone, she gave me a great welcome, but it was heartbreaking to see her searching everywhere for her sisters. For many days to come, she gazed into the bush and called for them. She followed us everywhere, evidently fearing that we too might desert her. To reassure her, we kept her in the house. She slept on our bed, and we were often woken by her rough tongue licking our faces. As soon as we could make the necessary arrangements, we took her on safari in order to break this atmosphere of waiting and distress, and luckily, she took to all that safari means and loved it as much as we did. We camped by the Waso Niiro River, whose banks are lined with daum palm and acacia bush. In the dry season, the shallow waters flow slowly down to the Lorraine swamp, passing some rapids and forming many deep pools, which are full of fish. In the late afternoon, the sun turned the country into a blaze of warm colours. This was the most enjoyable part of the day. The shadows lengthened and became a deep purple, until by the rapid sinking of the sun all details were extinguished. A faint bird call died gradually away. The world grew silent. All was in suspense, awaiting the darkness and with it the awakening of the bush. Then the long-drawn call of the hyenas gave the signal and the hunt began. One particular evening, I secured Elsa to a tree in front of the tents, and she started to chew her dinner, while I sat in the darkness and listened. I heard a deep vibrating sound, like that of distant aircraft. This meant the elephant were making their way to the river. Luckily, the wind was in our favour, and the rumbling soon ceased. Suddenly, the unmistakable grunt of lion became audible. What could Elsa be thinking about this? In fact, she seemed utterly unconcerned at the approach of her own kind. She tore at her meat, then rolled on her back, all four paws in the air, and dozed off, while I sat listening to the chuckling of hyena, the yelping of jackal, and the magnificent chorus of the lions. It was very hot that season, so Elsa spent part of the day in the water. She would splash us whenever she found us off our guard, or she would jump quickly out of the water, pounce on us, wet as she was, and we would find ourselves rolling in the sand with our cameras, field glasses and rifles pressed down by her heavy, dripping body. Whenever she discovered some elephant droppings, she at once rolled in them. Indeed, it seemed that she regarded them as an ideal bath powder. She hugged them and rubbed the perfume well into her skin. Rhino droppings she also found attractive. In fact, she liked the droppings of most herbivorous animals, but preferred those of pachyderms. We often wondered about this behaviour. Could it come from an instinct to disguise her own scent from the animals, that in a natural state she would kill and eat? We never saw her roll in the droppings of carnivorous animals. Elsa was very careful in placing her droppings always a few yards away from the game paths, where we usually walked. When we returned to Iziolo, the rains had started. The country was covered with little rivulets and pools. This provided fine fun for Elsa. She splashed in every one of them, and greatly invigorated, proceeded with pouncing leaps to cover us with what she evidently considered to be heavenly mud. This was beyond a joke. We had to make her realize that she had grown too heavy for such light-hearted flying jumps. We explained the situation to her by the judicious use of a small stick. She understood at once, and thereafter we very seldom had to make use of it, though we always carried it as a reminder. By now Elsa also understood the meaning of no, and she would obey even when tempted by antelope. Often it was touching to see her torn between her hunting instinct and her wish to please us. Anything moving seemed to her, as it would to most dogs, just asking to be chased. But as yet, her instinct to kill had not fully developed. Of course, we had been careful never to show her her goat meat alive. She had plenty of opportunity of seeing wild animals, but as we were usually with her when this happened, she gave chase merely in play and always came back to us after a short time, rubbed her head against our knees, and told us with a low meow about the game. We had animals of all kinds around our house, a herd of waterbuck and impala antelope, and about 60 reticulated giraffes had been our neighbours for many years. Elsa met them on every walk and they got to know her very well and even allowed her to stalk them to within a few yards before they quietly turned away. But it was an exciting moment.